This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this month, thousands of Granite Staters, many clad in pink, gathered in various cities to participate in fundraising walks for breast cancer awareness and research. But at the same time, there's been a lot of confusion, even anger recently, over guidelines for breast cancer screening. Last week, the American Cancer Society released new recommendations for when most women should have annual mammograms, raising the age from 40 to 45. Also, the group said women 55 and up should only have mammograms once every 2 years. But other health organizations say age 40 should still be the standard, while others say age 50 makes more sense for those female patients who have no family history. One thing is clear. For women, it seems increasingly difficult to know who to listen to and what to do when it comes to keeping tabs on this disease. This hour on The Exchange, making sense of the new mammography guidelines, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us in studio is Nancy Ryan, president of the New Hampshire Breast Cancer Coalition, field coordinator for the National Breast Cancer Coalition, and a survivor herself of the disease. And Nancy, welcome back. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also with us, Dr. Connie Campbell, surgical director of breast health at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester. And Dr. Campbell, thank you for making time out. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, Dr. Gilbert Welch, professor of community and family medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, author of Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not, and Here's Why. Dr. Welch, welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And joining us for a few moments from Framingham, Mass. Is Neil Manyar. He's vice president of health systems at the New England Division of the American Cancer Society. And Neil, thank you very much for taking time out.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, and Neil, I'll start with you since you guys are the ones who made headlines with these new recommendations. Why did the American Cancer Society feel these guidelines needed to be updated?
These guidelines reflect our improved understanding of the benefits, the risks, the effectiveness of mammography screening, and they really offer women a much more personalized approach as opposed to a one-size-fits-all approach to these really important screening decisions. The updating of the guidelines is really based on all of the evidence that has accumulated since the last guidelines were published back in 2003, and the evidence that really gives us a much better understanding of the risks and benefits that are associated with mammography screening. So that was really the catalyst for developing these new guidelines. It's really an evolution of our understanding and a shift towards a much more personalized approach, and one that really balances the benefits and the risk of mammography screening and helps women make informed decisions and really empowers them to make the decision that's right for them.
Well, the idea that screening can bring, as you say, benefits and risks, that's a hard concept to wrap your head around, Neil. I mean, we always hear, especially with breast cancer, that early screening saves lives. So how could early screening bring risks?
So breast cancer at certain ages is less common, and screening at a certain age can bring with it the risk of having a false positive result. So being diagnosed or finding a suspicious area and then going through the process of further diagnosis, potential biopsy, and then realizing that there was no cancer present at all, or having an overdiagnosis of cancer. So detecting a cancer that really would not have become clinically evident had it not been treated at all, but detecting it and then going through a treatment regimen that itself brings different risks. So at certain age points, the risks of benefits in terms of the risks of screening in terms of false positive findings or overdiagnosis can be much higher than the benefits derived from detecting a cancer early. At another age point, that balance shifts to being much more favorable towards having more benefits, that it is better for women to become screened. And that was really the American Cancer Society is proposing with these new guidelines, which is that at age 40, all women should begin the discussion of mammography screening and should really begin to understand the risks and benefits associated with mammography screening and then make the decision that's right for them. So the ACS fully supports women beginning screening at age 40 if they want to. At age 45, all women of average risk should begin mammography screening, because that's when this balance shifts towards a more favorable balance for benefits for all women.
Well, and I want to bring everybody else in, and so much to sort through. Nancy, to you next, please. You know, again, the idea that mammography could bring both benefits and harms. I've been told since forever that early screening saves lives. I mean, how do you figure out the harms of mammography?
So I just want to say at the outset that the New Hampshire Breast Cancer Coalition is not a medical organization, so we don't give medical advice. We do take positions on various pieces of legislation at the state level and the national level, but we don't issue screening guidelines, and we do encourage women to understand the controversies about screening. So I'm welcoming the conversation. I think that it didn't surprise me that ACS has put out some revised guidelines. The conversation about breast cancer screening with mammography has been going on for 40 years. When I was diagnosed in 1989, the recommendation from the American Cancer Society was to have your first mammogram at age 35.
I remember that.
So as the science changes over the years, we're learning more about the risks and the benefits. I think we should be putting less energy into the conversation about who should be screened, when and how often, and looking at the number of women we're losing to breast cancer every year. We're still losing 40,000 women in the United States to breast cancer every year, and we need to be understanding how to prevent breast cancer and how to prevent metastasis. This is the goal of the National Breast Cancer Coalition's Breast Cancer Deadline 2020. And that's where a lot of our focus is right now.
Well, Nancy, if I could ask you a personal question, how was your cancer found? Was it found through a mammogram?
It was not. In fact, three mammograms missed my cancer. I had a baseline mammogram when I was 35. Several months later, I found a very small lump. I went back to my primary care doctor. He was very comforting. He said, well, your mammogram is just fine, so, you know, let's see you back in 6 months. I was rather uncomfortable with that, so I sought the advice of a surgeon. And long story short, a period of 14 months elapsed between the time that I found the lump and the breast cancer was diagnosed. There was a lot of information missing at the time. The type of breast cancer that I had was called lobular, which is notorious for not showing up on mammograms.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and about 20% of invasive breast cancers are missed by mammography. I think that it's really important now that women understand as much as they can about breast cancer. And as I said, I'm welcoming the conversation about the risks and the harms of mammography screening.
Well, and another recommendation from the American Cancer Society is that doctors skip clinical breast exams in which a physician manually checks for lumps. And this is for women of any age. But it sounds like, Nancy, that's how yours was found, not through a physician, but through self-check.
Well, it wasn't a formal self-exam. And in fact, breast self-exam has now been shown to make no difference in breast cancer mortality. That is, the systematic examination by a woman on a particular day of the month has been shown in a very large clinical trial to make no difference whatsoever in breast cancer mortality. That said, women should understand their own bodies. They should be familiar with what's normal for them. And in fact, most of the lumps that women find are not through a systematic breast self-exam. It's in the shower or when they're dressing, or a partner may find it. So the guidelines are changing over the years. It's not a surprise.
Well, Dr. Welch, I'm sure I'm feeling the way a lot of our female listeners are feeling. You know, things keep changing. We're told to do this. And then 5 years later, whoops, nope, don't do that anymore. And then we hear from Nancy that the mammogram didn't even catch her cancer. I mean, how are women supposed to sort this out, Dr. Welch, if you and the medical community keep changing your minds?
Well, first, I think everyone should know, we all agree you should be aware of your breasts. If you notice a new lump, get a mammogram. That is not screening. That's a diagnostic test. I think everybody agrees about that. The questions come about how aggressively to look for early forms of the disease. And the American Cancer Society, in this new guideline, you know, all of a sudden acknowledges that there are two sides to that story. The harder we look for early breast cancer, the earlier we start, the more often we do it, comes with more harm. It means we have more false alarms, we do more overdiagnosis, and screening becomes a balancing act. And I think what women should take from all this sort of changes in mammography guidelines and the fact that different groups say different things, they should recognize, wow, this is a close call. This is not something, you know, we all doctors agree we should treat really, really high blood pressure. No one debates that. The mammography story for screening is a much, much closer call. And the American Cancer Society now has recognized this is a choice where different individuals with the same risk profile may make different decisions based on how they feel about the benefits and harms.
Well, and there are some women now who are doing what's called active monitoring, and we'll definitely talk about that later. But Dr. Campbell, again, you're surgical director of breast health at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester. How are you helping your patients sort through this over the past week since these new guidelines came out?
So I think it is very important to think about individual risk. And the guidelines that the American Cancer Society put out are actually for women who are at average risk. So they're not for women who are at increased risk. And sort of buried in those guidelines, which hasn't necessarily been prominently featured in the news, is the fact that women are at average risk, not even if they have increased density of their breasts. So 50% of women have increased density in their breasts. So this is a more limited guideline recommendation, and I think it's important for people to know their risk. So if these guidelines are for only people who are at average risk, how do you find out your risk? And that actually can be a more difficult thing than you would think. So there are many different breast cancer risk calculators that you can go online and look at. And if you plug your data into each and every one of them, you'll get a very different number. And that said, most of those breast risk calculations don't take into account density of the breast, which is important, as well as certain pathologic findings that are lobular neoplasias that are important for patients. So I think the most important thing to recognize from these guidelines change is that it's very important to talk to your physician about what your risk is, because it's very true. One size doesn't fit all, and it's important to have some idea of your risk.
Well, I remember here in New Hampshire, there was a mammogram screening campaign. This is in the mid-90s, so a while ago, and as Neil and Dr. Welch said, our understanding is evolving. But this campaign, the main message was, your risk factor for breast cancer is if you're a woman and you're getting older, which pretty much includes everyone. Is that no longer our understanding? Because that was the message back then, and it was, you know, hit pretty hard.
So certainly if you are a woman, you're at increased risk of having breast cancer versus a man. Men do get breast cancer. Generally, it's 100-to-1 ratio, but it does happen, and I do have male patients. It unfortunately doesn't get picked up very early.
Right, because they're not getting mammograms.
Well, not so much that they're not getting mammograms, but people don't think about it. So typically my male patients will have a breast mass for quite a period of time.
Wow.
And their physicians are aware of that and the patient is aware of it, but it doesn't go any further because people aren't thinking about it. So do I think that women are at increased risk versus men? Absolutely. And if you look at the data, certainly the incidence of breast cancer rises with age. So those are two risk factors right there. But there are many other risk factors, you know, such as, you know, your weight and when you start your period and did you breastfeed your children and how much alcohol do you drink and when do you drink it? Do you drink it before your first pregnancy or after your first pregnancy? Have you had biopsies? What's your family history? Do you exercise? There are a lot of risk factors that go into determining someone's risk.
Sounds like a long conversation with your doctor then, not just should I at 40 or not.
That's correct.
Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we try to sort through the various information that women are receiving these days over mammogram guidelines. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Michelle is joining us from Hampton Falls. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The issue I have is mammography is a big business. And we are asked to have these tests on a regular basis.
Michelle, I'm having a really hard time hearing you. I do apologize. I hate to cut you off. I'm wondering if you can call back or send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Something funky with the phone lines there. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Neil, with the American Cancer Society, I did want to address one huge concern with you and get other thoughts as well. And that's healthcare rationing, that with these new guidelines, the fear is insurers will say, hey, we're off the hook. We don't have to cover these for 40-year-olds anymore. And a woman who does have some very real fears, such as Dr. Campbell described, will be told she needs to pay out of pocket. Is that a valid concern or not, Neil?
At the moment, we don't anticipate that these guidelines will have an impact on insurance status and insurance coverage. Insurance companies typically look at a range of different data sources to inform their decisions of what to cover and what not to cover. So these guidelines, if we compare them to the United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines, which have much more influence on insurance decisions, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends that women begin screening at age 50. However, where there's alignment between these guidelines and other guidelines is that at age 40, they all recommend that women should begin the discussion around whether or not to get a breast cancer screening. So we don't think, at least in the near term, that this is going to have any impact on insurance coverage. What we're hoping is that, on the contrary, that more women will begin to think about the decision of whether or not to get mammography, will begin to have these discussions. And then at the American Cancer Society, we are absolutely committed to making sure that we do everything possible to ensure that everyone who needs and wants a screening test will be able to get it.
Well, a spokeswoman for America's Health Insurance Plan, an insurance advocacy group, has been widely quoted as saying, quote, the recommendations will give plans a different framework for evaluating those coverage decisions moving forward, and that insurance plans will certainly take these updated recommendations into account when evaluating their coverage policies. That sounds, Neil, like an opening toward curtailing coverage.
I think only time will tell, but we don't think that will actually be the case. We think that the insurance companies, again, they look at a number of different data sources and a number of different guidelines to make these decisions, and I think the value of prevention and the focus on prevention is really front and center right now. So what we're hoping is that these guidelines will really help people make more informed decisions, and for the insurance companies that they will continue to cover mammography screening, and we will continue to certainly advocate for making sure that women have access to mammography screening.
Just last question for you real quick, Neil, please. What advice would you give doctors who are trying to help their patients navigate this shifting world of advice?
I think the most critical piece of advice is to, one, make sure that these discussions do begin at age 40 and that women have the needed information to make an informed decision. These guidelines do empower women. They're designed to empower women to both have access to this information and to make their decisions that are right for them. I think the other thing about these guidelines is that they really do take into account personal preferences and values, and this is an important part of the conversation that women have with their physicians.
All right.
And in the clinical decision-making process.
Neil, thank you very much for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Have
That's
a good day.
Neil Manyar, Vice President of Health Systems at the New England Division of the American Cancer Society. More in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, making sense of mammogram guidelines. As we've been hearing, the American Cancer Society has issued a new recommendation raising the age for annual screenings from 40 to 45, saying that too many false positives had led to unnecessary and even harmful treatment. Other organizations, though, suggest other ages for this test. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests in studio are Nancy Ryan, president of the New Hampshire Breast Cancer Coalition, field coordinator for the National Breast Cancer Coalition, and a survivor of the disease. Dr. Connie Campbell is here, surgical director of breast health at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester. And from Hanover, Dr. Gilbert Welch, professor of community and family medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, author of the book, Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not, and Here's Why, as well as Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. Again, the phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, I did want to give everybody a chance to address the question I asked Neil from the American Cancer Society just before the break. And Nancy Ryan, that's the question of whether insurers will use these new recommendations to deny coverage for mammograms.
So I think that we don't know exactly what insurance companies are going to do with this at this point. I will say I did receive an email last week issued by the Kaiser Health News, and their assessment was that the new guidelines on their own likely won't change insurer or employer decisions regarding coverage of screening for breast cancer. Experts agree. And I'd like to echo the comments that Neil made, that there are advocacy groups who are very much interested in ensuring that women have access to quality screening and treatment. That has been a hallmark goal of the National Breast Cancer Coalition since its inception.
So access doesn't necessarily mean everybody at 40 jumps and has it done, but they have access if they fit one of those risk profiles that Dr. Campbell talked
about. Well, access in the broadest term of the word. All races, all economic status, everyone should have access to quality screening and treatment. And the National Breast Cancer Coalition has made this a goal since its inception.
Yeah. Dr. Welch, what do you think?
Well, I'm certainly not going to predict what the insurance companies are going to do.
That's the fear, though.
I do think it's important for people to understand what special treatment screening gets in insurance right now. A woman who wants to be screened can have a free mammogram, while a woman who has a new lump actually pays cost shares on a diagnostic mammogram. So I think some of the financial incentives out there are kind of crazy right now, where well people can get free screening tests, but people with established disease need to have copays and so forth. But I want to be clear that even if you had all the money in the world, this issue is so much more than about money. If you have all the money in the world, the questions of early detection, the trade-offs of early detections are still relevant to individuals to try to decide how they want to deal with the two sides of looking for early forms of disease, the potential that you might help and the potential you might find something, act on it, have false alarms, all for nothing. And it's a very fine trade-off, and that's why you see all these different recommendations.
Well, I'd like to give you a chance to jump in on this idea too, Dr. Welch, of the harm that we heard from Neil, you know, risks and harm that can come from a false positive. What is the harm of a false positive? A lot of women have had them, and many of them will say, phew, you know, I'm glad I went in for that extra screening or that extra biopsy, and now I feel better. So what's the harm there?
Well, I want to be clear. I think the major harm of early detection screening programs is overdiagnosis. But if you want to talk about false alarms, that's the most frequent harm. And in a 10-year course of annual screening in this country, upwards of half of women will have at least one false alarm. And for many women, this is a very minor thing. You just get a second mammogram. For some, it involves a biopsy. For others, it involves getting back a result that isn't cancer but isn't normal, and they're left in some limbo where they have dysplasia, aplasia, and they have to keep coming in, and they just have this source of worry without any resolution. You know, if we find a breast cancer, we treat it, but instead we find something in between. But I agree, different women will perceive, have different, very different experiences about how they feel about false alarms.
How do you help your patients sort through that, Dr. Campbell? You know, a false alarm, maybe it's a problem, maybe it's not. How aggressive you want to be if it looks like a cancer that, that isn't going to jump and spread quickly. Dr. Welch has called them, I think, what do you call them, Gil? Turtles, rabbits?
I don't really get credit for the term, but they've been labeled turtles. Yeah,
yeah, the ones that are slow growing that
aren't
probably
going
won't
anywhere,
go anywhere
anyway.
So I think that, you know, it's a matter of perspective. I think that if a woman has a breast mass and she has a biopsy and the result comes back that she doesn't have cancer, I can tell her, wow, this was a test that you didn't need to have done. Or I can say, congratulations, you don't have cancer, and they're pretty happy about that. So part of it is a matter of perspective, and I think that, you know, there are people who do want to be treated earlier when it's treatable and curable versus waiting until it's spread. In terms of the issue of the turtles,
the ones that won't spread, or
well,
we think won't spread.
That you think, and so you don't really know. And so I think that, you know, Dr. Welch talks about the barnyard of cancer, that you have all these different animals. You have the turtles and the rabbits and the birds and things like that. But the real truth is that I, as a clinician, seeing a patient sitting in my office, I don't get the benefit, that prospective benefit of seeing a turtle or whatever other animal, but they might all look like eggs to me. And I don't know what's going to hatch out of there without further evaluation. And the patient trying to figure out what risk they're willing to take. Might they, as an individual, have a cancer that, you know, has that potential to be cured if we find it and treat it now? Or maybe it's going to be one of those slower growing cancers. And what if it is a slower growing cancer? You know, maybe it just slowly grows and it's not going to kill you. You know, so it's not going to affect the mortality, which is addressed in these guidelines, but it's going to sort of, you know, fester, if you will, and cause a problem. So I see women who have come in and they've had cancer for a long time and they have opted not to have treatment or have been counseled not to have treatment. And now they have this big sore on their chest and it bleeds and it smells bad and things like that. So it's not killing them, but it is affecting the quality of their life. So again, I don't think that it's so easy to prospectively figure out what's going to cause a problem, what problem it's going to be, and how that problem is going to affect you.
That's the thing. How do you figure out which one is going to kill you, you know, and spread to other parts of your body and so forth, and which one is just going to sit there and hang out for 25 years?
So there's certain information that involves, you know, testing and obviously expense and investigation that some might argue stresses people out. But there is information that, you know, we can do. We test to see if it can, you know, what type of cancer is it? Is it ductal? Is it lobular? Is it invasive? Is it non-invasive? Does it have estrogen and progesterone receptors or does it not? Does it overexpress certain cancer genes? And now there's even more testing, so basically genomic profiling of cancers through some tests that are called Oncotype DX or MammaPrint that can give us a better sense of how likely is a cancer to occur and how aggressive is it. And that helps the oncologist guide treatment. So there is some information out there, but still at the beginning of figuring out if you have a mass that maybe you haven't found, because now I think, you know, people are being counseled that they shouldn't do a breast self-exam, they shouldn't have a doctor do an exam, and they shouldn't have a mammogram. You know, how are we going to find this? At what point do we let it get to before we start figuring out, is it an aggressive cancer or is it not?
Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go to Nashua next. Donna's on the air. Hi, Donna. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you.
Sure.
I was wondering if anyone could speak to the idea of thermographic mammograms that are supposed to be so much safer and much more accurate. Is that ever going to be on the horizon as far as insurance coverage?
Thermographic mammograms, Donna. That's what you said, right?
Yeah.
Thermographic. Okay.
Like a, yeah.
Do you want to address that, Dr. Campbell, first?
So I think that's, you know, another imaging technique that's out there. And it's not clear where that fits into everything. And I think that when we can't really agree on the standard mammograms that we have there, that I haven't seen any insurance coverage for that. So I'm not sure that it's clear where that's going to fit into breast imaging.
Thank you for the call, Donna. And the number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's a comment from Melinda on Facebook. She says, I'm sure it must happen, but I have known many people who have had breast cancer and very few who have had false diagnoses. My mother, Melinda says, had a questionable mammogram 6 months before she had stage 3 breast cancer. 2 years would have been catastrophic. Melinda says it's all well and good to look at these numbers, but very different when it's you or someone you care about. Dr. Welch, what do you think about Melinda's comment? Lots of people have breast cancer. Who cares about the few who have false diagnoses? We want to know.
Well, I think that's where preferences come in and how different women feel about it. I think one thing to have is some sense of the order of magnitude here. And as I said, false alarms are by far the most common harm. But the UK in the United Kingdom, in their invitation to women to consider screening, acknowledges that for every woman who avoids a breast cancer death because of screening, there are probably 3 women who are overdiagnosed. Now, that's in a country that's not looking as hard for breast cancer as we are. Norway just had a review, and they estimated that for every woman who avoided a breast cancer death, 5 women were overdiagnosed and treated. I can't tell you what to do with that data because I think different people can hear that in different ways. And women who understand the two sides of mammography and want to pursue it, I'm all for that. I think we also ought to be clear that the women that don't enjoy mammography and have never felt good about it should feel equally good about the decision not to pursue it. And I think what's changing here, and it's not just changing in mammography, is we're all allowing for a more balanced view of early detection. Early on, it was something people must do. It was an unambiguous good. And now we're recognizing that there are side effects to the process and there are choices involved. And I think that's a healthy way for us to move. And as I said, it's more than just mammography. We're seeing sort of pap smear screening. We're backing off on how frequent we're doing it. The American College of Physicians has now recommended that we stop doing pelvic exams on women. We're just beginning to recognize that there are two sides to this story and that there really is a balance.
Nancy, I can see you want to jump in there.
Well, I'm appreciating the conversation about the nuances around this issue, but it may be that we're getting into a little bit more detail than the general audience can absorb in 1 hour. I'd like to go back to what you said earlier, Laura, that we used to think that, finding a cancer early and small and treating it would be the surefire way to end a death from breast cancer. But this model no longer applies based on the science and the understanding of the biology that we have now of breast cancer. And there was a quote in the Boston Globe by Sharon Bagley that really summarized the way that I look at it. She wrote, "It turns out that some cancers detected by mammograms would never have posed a threat to a woman's health or life. Others are so slow-growing that even if they're not detected until they cause symptoms, they're treatable. Still others are so aggressive that even catching them early is too late." And I think that's information that women really need to understand when they take into account whether or not they want to undergo routine mammographic screening.
It's so hard to, I hear what you're saying, and I've read that too, Nancy, and yet it's so hard for any woman who gets a diagnosis of breast cancer. It's hard to listen to the second part of that, but it's a cancer that's not going to grow, so, just live with it. that's a really hard message to hear.
Well, and this is hard for us to get our brains around because we have been so imbued. It's like motherhood and apple pie that you get your mammograms.
Right.
So we really need doctors and physicians like Dr. Campbell who are willing to take the time and spend with their patients and explain the more nuanced issues around screening.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's a Facebook comment from Joan. As a breast cancer survivor, I feel any non-invasive method to detect this disease is a good thing. This is nothing but a ploy by the insurance companies to cut costs at the expense of women. As far as eliminating the doctor's physical check, which takes all of 40 seconds, Joan says, are they also eliminating prostate exams? Joan says, this is anything for a buck mentality. It's taking control of every aspect of our lives. Despicable, she says. You know, Dr. Campbell, we talked about this earlier, but I do wonder what you think. I mean, this idea that, you know, let's just save some money and tell women that they don't need to do these things when, in fact, office exam takes 40 seconds. She's right.
So I think that there is relatively little harm in a woman doing a breast check on herself. And if she has an awareness of what her breasts are like, if there's an abnormality, she can go and get it checked. She doesn't have to be alarmed and raise a red flag. And I don't think every woman does that. I think that women might have a question, is this normal or not? And they get that resolved and they're not anxious and they're not having all these issues that maybe the press would think that you do. From a clinician breast exam, I think there's a lot of variability in how someone does an exam. I will say mine does take more than 40 seconds. But when
that's probably a good thing.
When I see my patients and I talk to them about where they're going to get their follow-up exams, you know, what I gather from women is that there is variability in how physicians do their exams. And I don't think that's something that definitely should just be cut out. I also think that it makes it difficult to look in these, you know, studies of a clinician breast exam because I don't think all exams are the same. So I don't think that those are necessarily bad things. I think that, you know, having a balanced view is important. And I think that there are a lot of women out there who are already choosing not to have mammograms. I know because I see those patients. So, you know, I see patients who have decided not to have mammograms because they're uncomfortable and now they've come in and they have, you know, big breast cancer. And I see patients who were busy last year and didn't have their mammogram and they skipped it and now they have breast cancer. And so,
yikes.
You know, people are already making these choices. And maybe, you know, as Dr. Welsh says, that it was a must do, but people have been making individual health decisions all along. And now we're just having more discussion about it.
Here's an email that just came in from Rebecca, who says, I am listening to the program and am concerned about women who are under the age of 40. At age 35, I had several biopsies and 6 months later found a lump, myself, that was a golf ball sized tumor. Wow, Rebecca. She says it was a fast growing aggressive cancer and they even thought it had grown through my chest wall before I had the mammogram. I had to have both chemo and radiation. I'm very lucky to be alive, but I'm wondering if mammograms shouldn't begin at 30. Even though breast tissue is so dense. And Rebecca says, by the way, no history of breast cancer in my family. Dr. Welch, wow. I mean, you hear these stories and you go, okay, let's just do it. What's the harm?
Well, first, bad cancers can happen at any age. And the question, as Nancy pointed out, the question of whether that cancer could be found early is still an open question. And this is the complexity of the heterogeneity of cancer, that cancers grow at different rates, and some of the worst ones grow so fast that they've already spread by the time they're detectable. And so mammography isn't the perfect answer any more than molecular breast imaging is, or thermography, or MRI testing of the breast. Early detection is never going to catch all the cancers that are relevant. It's lucky to catch a couple of them, and then the question is whether it actually changes the course of those cancers.
All right, and we will talk more in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, changes to the American Cancer Society recommendations for mammograms is the topic. All the questions surrounding these and some anger and frustration that the guidelines for women and mammograms keep shifting. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Nancy Ryan, Dr. Connie Campbell, Dr. Welch, let's go right back to our listeners and to Celia, who's calling from Thornton. Hi, Celia. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Morning to your doctors. I'll try to be brief. I'm an RN. I was diagnosed at age 70 with triple negative breast cancer, which is invasive and aggressive. I had felt a ridge for 3 years prior to this mammo, and I had not had the mammo for those 3 years. It was very small. There were clear margins, no sentinel node involvement, no metastasis at all. And I elected to do, even though it was triple negative, I elected to have radiation only, and I'm going into my fourth year post-op. Recommendation I would have is most definitely mammos for whatever age or time of life the doctors recommend currently. I think we have to go with current recommendations. The other thing is I think women have to read up on possible courses of treatment. I read the Susan B. Love Breast book. I read it as a Bible, and it's very, very thick. And that way, I was in some control of my choice of treatments. And that would be my recommendation if it's of value to the program.
So, Celia, saying that you chose to do radiation, could you have chosen a more aggressive treatment?
Yes, I could. But circumstances were that my mother was dying of pancreatic cancer at the time.
Wow, I'm sorry.
And I felt I didn't want to be not able to deal with her health choices or make choices for her. She was in her mid-90s. So, and it was all I could deal with, Laura. And I actually walked out of a Boston hospital and said, I'm done after the double lumpectomy. And it was a doctor in New Hampshire who said, at the very least, do radiation. And I'm really glad I did that. Funny ending to the story. Fourth this year, I had my checkup, and I said, how am I looking at a cure? Because with triple negative, they say recurrence can go from 0 to 5 years, and I'm in my fourth year. Am I cured? And will I be cured in 5 years? And he looked at me and he said, as far as I'm concerned, I consider you cured. And I said, oh, it must be the flaxseed. And he said, no, it was the radiation.
Well, what a double whammy for you, Celia.
Yeah,
boy.
But just like all your other callers, I feel very fortunate. But women have to educate themselves. And even in the shock of diagnosis, you have to just focus your attention on education. I've started breast cancer groups in Florida, which is where I'll go next week. And I've had some wonderful women who have shared their story and have received support from each other. And women also have to do that, I feel. Talk to someone who's had it.
All right.
They
well,
can
Celia,
tell you their story.
Thank you so much for telling your story. And, Dr. Welch, it reminds me of a piece I read in Time magazine on this topic that Celia raises about, shifting attitudes about breast cancer, which course of treatment do you take? Mm-hmm. Some women go for a full mastectomy right away. Others, less aggressive treatments like Celia. Some women and their doctors who are choosing to do what's called active monitoring, Dr. Welch. These are patients who have cancers not believed to be the type that spread, a type called DCIS. What are your thoughts around this?
Well, first I want to echo the endorsement of the Susan Love book. It's an excellent book. And I think it is important. This is when women really do need to be engaged in the question of treatment and whether to treat, as the Time magazine article raised that whole idea that's been longstanding in prostate cancer. Should we watch some small, low-grade prostate cancers? I think we're beginning to get to that point, we are beginning to get that point in both breast and thyroid cancer, offering that as a option. And I think one of the things that gets lost because we put so much emphasis on early detection, overstating its benefits and downplaying its harm, we've kind of lost how important treatment is. And treatment is what is really important, and Dr. Campbell knows this better than I. This is where there's been really good news in breast cancer, and I think often we tend to dismiss this, but breast cancer treatments have improved greatly over the last 20 years. The advent of adjuvant chemotherapy and hormonal therapy are huge strides for a lot of breast cancers. So I think it's a good step to involve patients some more in the treatment and give them options. And women should know that they have time to make these decisions. We've probably overstated the need to act quickly.
You know, in that Time magazine article as well, that again talked about women choosing these less aggressive options when their cancer seems less aggressive, there was a chart here, and I want to share it with you and get your thoughts. How deadly is breast cancer? Roughly 1.3 million U.S. women die per year. Some leading causes: 22% heart disease, 18% cancer excluding breast, 5% Alzheimer's, and 3% breast cancer. Dr. Welch, I turn to you first. I was stunned by this chart. Again, maybe I'm of that age where I grew up in that era where you were just sort of bombarded with this message. I was surprised by that.
We've overstated the risk of breast cancer death in part to promote efforts of early detection, which I think is not a healthy thing to do for a society. But the lifetime risk of breast cancer death is about 3%. It's actually a little lower than that now. It's about the same as the risk of a man dying from prostate cancer, roughly 3%. So it's certainly not the only risk women face. To be fair, it is arguably the most important cancer for a non-smoking woman to worry about. Obviously, if the woman smokes, she should worry more about lung cancer and heart disease. But for women who don't smoke, it's still an important cancer, so no one should diminish it. But the good news is we're really much better at treating it. And, you know, breast cancer mortality in the last 20 years is down 30%. And that's a tribute to good treatment.
Well, and that's what those numbers reflect, too, Dr. Welch. Not that breast cancer isn't a threat, but that we're doing so well at treating it. Nancy and Dr. Campbell, Nancy, you first. How do you receive those numbers that I just read?
So I think that there's a really good booklet that the Breast Cancer Action Group out in San Francisco has put out called Should I Get a Mammogram?
And wow, that's kind of what we're talking about today, isn't it?
So it really summarizes the pros and cons. And their conversation about risk assessment is very interesting. They say many women overestimate the risk of breast cancer and underestimate the harms. And in the chart, the perceived risk, and this was through focus groups, is that a 40-year-old's chance of developing breast cancer over the next decade is somewhere between 20 and 50%.
Well, that's a lot.
The National Cancer Institute says your actual risk is 1.4%. So another perception that women have is with screening, the number of breast cancer deaths decreases by 50%. In actuality, of 1,050 year old women, about 5 are likely to die of breast cancer in the next 10 years. With screening, it just drops to 4. So there's a huge disconnect between a woman's perception of breast cancer and the actual numbers.
Wow. And you say that as somebody whose breast cancer was found at 35.
It was actually at 40.
At 40. Okay. Mm-hmm. So sort of outside that treatment window that is now being recommended.
But the median age for diagnosis is 61. Also important information.
What do you think about those numbers, Dr. Campbell? Are we overly afraid of breast cancer? Have we been made to be too afraid of it?
I don't know that we've been made to be too afraid of it, but I think that the numbers are what they are. And again, we're looking at deaths related to these diseases. And so there's many different ways that women and men are impacted by their breast cancer. And Dr. Welch is correct. There's been great advances in the treatment of breast cancer, both from a surgical and sort of minimally invasive perspective, as well as from chemotherapy and radiation that really, you know, targets more the breast versus the, you know, structures behind the heart and the lungs. And so these have been really good advances. But women are not just affected by death. They're affected by losing a breast or going through chemotherapy and having, you know, neuropathies associated with chemotherapy and all these other things, maybe how their partner perceives them or how they feel about themselves or their confidence that they have. And so there are a lot of other things other than just the endpoint of death of perhaps why this is more, you know, more prominent in the society's thought process than coronary artery disease or something like that. However, when we talk about risk factors, you know, if you're exercising regularly, that can significantly decrease your risk of breast cancer by 20 to 30%. But it also has a beneficial potential effect on your coronary artery disease. So I think that a lot of these risk factors target all those things that you're talking about, and that it's important to have these conversations with your physician about how can you be most healthy.
Here's an email that came in from Susie in Canaan. I'm a 44-year-old woman with no risk factors for breast cancer. Susie says, I do have a real diagnosed anxiety disorder for which I take daily medication. If I have an anxiety crisis, it causes serious medical harm. For me, the risk of a false positive is too great to get a yearly mammogram. Mm-hmm. Susie, thank you for that. Here's one from Virginia. I found a tiny pea-sized lump in my breast during a breast self-exam. It turned out to be stage one, and I'm doing fine after lumpectomy and radiation. Virginia says, I'd like to encourage women who comfortably do self-exams every month to continue doing so, just as the schedule for mammogram screening should not be one size fits all. Similarly, breast self-exams work well for some women, but not for all. Some women may find it simply adds to their anxiety, getting back to what Susie was talking about. Virginia suggests doctors question women about how they feel about it and let each woman decide rather than giving the same advice to all. That sounds like something you would say, Dr. Campbell, just based on what you've said earlier during this program.
That's correct.
All right, Virginia, thank you for the email. Here's another one from Bill. He says, this is also a problem for men as well. You can't get help until a problem shows up, sometimes too late to do anything. Bill says the annual checkup is pretty much a farce. There are no good battery of diagnostic tests. You know, Dr. Campbell, you mentioned you do have male patients earlier, and maybe this is a problem that there's no mammograms for men. And so sometimes they come to see you when it's getting pretty far along in the process.
So I'm certainly not advocating for mammograms for men from a screening perspective, but I think that if, you know, a man feels his chest and that there's a mass there, that seeking appropriate attention is a good idea and can often, you know, diagnose a breast cancer before it spread to the lymph nodes, which is often the case for men.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're taking your questions and comments about the new guidelines from the American Cancer Society regarding breast cancer. Another guideline that we've talked about a little bit, but I want to ask you both about a little bit more. Women at age 55 are encouraged, Nancy Ryan, to cut back to one mammogram every 2 years. So once again, things are shifting.
So if there was any piece of the new guidelines that caused concern for me, that was it. Because one of the risk factors for breast cancer is growing older. And you would think that continuing with annual mammograms past age 55 and up to age 70, I don't think we have a lot of research on women ages 70 and older, but the annual mammogram through age 70, if the woman is healthy and is expected to have a long, you know, healthy life, seems to me prudent. So I still need to understand a little bit more about why ACS is suggesting that women transition to biennial mammography at age 55.
Yeah, and go ahead, Dr. Campbell, and Dr. Welch, I want to hear from you too, but go ahead, Dr. Campbell, how do you feel about this piece of the recommendations?
I think that the American Cancer Society was looking to decrease the harm in the situation, and so decrease that false positive rate by changing the interval. But I share Nancy's concern that as people age and, you know, it increases their incidence of cancer, that that will be a concern. And I think part of it, you know, depends on how you manage the false positive for patients. So if you have a patient who has an anxiety disorder, who's taking medications related to that, you know, then maybe you do want to decrease that because they're so anxious. But if you have someone who can handle a false positive in a way that doesn't negatively impact their life, then I think it's appropriate to continue with annual mammography.
I think another concern that plays into this is the issue of ductal carcinoma in situ, which you mentioned earlier,
That's
Laura.
That cancer that just stays within the milk ducts.
Abnormal cells that have built up in the duct that have not developed the biological capability to invade. So they're not life-threatening. And some years ago, we used to only find, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 DCAS diagnoses per year. This year, we're expected to diagnose 60,000 women with DCIS. And the dilemma is we don't know which of those DCIS will go on to develop invasive breast cancer and which will not. So there is some study going on around active surveillance.
Well, yeah, and that's related to that Time magazine piece I mentioned. They interviewed a couple women who had DCIS and had chosen, given the probability that this would not expand throughout the rest of the body, like you said, Nancy, to do sort of active watching. What's the harm, Dr. Welch, of a woman 55 plus having a mammogram every year instead of every 2 years like the Cancer Society now recommends?
Well, I think, as the other panelists have mentioned, this was an effort presumably to lower the false alarms, the frequency of false alarms and overdiagnosis. But it does give people a sense of just how the complexities of screening. You know, it's not just one thing. There's questions about when to start, when to stop, how frequently should we screen. And to me, the actual most important question is how hard should we look? How small an abnormality should we try to identify? And it's in that effort to always try to find more and find as many cancers as possible is when I think we get into trouble. And create more false alarms and more overdiagnosis. So we have to find a balance, and I think that's the main message that people should get is we're sort of struggling.
It's so hard, yeah, with all this information. And again, not to pick on you folks in the medical community, but you guys keep changing it. I understand research changes, information improves.
And it's a close call.
It's tough for patients.
It's a very close call.
Dr. Campbell, you want to jump in real quick there at the end.
I did. I just wanted to say that for patients who are deciding that they don't want to have treatment for their DCIS, that's important to recognize the difference between active monitoring and no treatment, because I've seen many patients who have opted not to have treatment and it has not just stayed in the duct, it has progressed. So don't just say, I'm not getting treatment. 10 years later, you're back with a problem.
All right. All of you, thank you so much. This is The Exchange on NHPR.